formidable a group of sponsors as Texans were ever likely to see. The backers included nearly everyone who was anyone in the state. Three former governors, John Connolly, Alan Shivers, and Price Daniel, served as co-chairmen. The editors or publishers of the San Antonio Light, the Austin American Statesman, the Houston Chronicle, the Dallas Times Herald, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Wichita Falls Times Record News, the Lubbock Avalanche Journal, the Corpus Christi Caller Times, the Beaumont Enterprise Journal, the Port Arthur News, the El Paso Times, and the San Angelo Standard Times were on it, not to mention dozens of smaller papers like the Bonham Favorite and the Waxahachie Times. The mayors of Midland, Dallas, Bay City, Corpus Christi, Austin, San Antonio, Laredo, Dallas, Lubbock, Fort Worth, and Arlington were on it. Presidents, chancellors, and regents of Texas universities were represented. Baylor, Texas Tech, the University of Texas, Texas A&M, Southern Methodist University. 143 of the 150 members of the Texas House of Representatives were on it. 28 of the 31 members of the Texas Senate were on it. The head of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission, lobbyists for railroads and manufacturers and municipalities, grocery store magnates, retired congressmen, Texas kingmakers such as Robert Strauss, later the head of the Democratic National Committee, and Leon Jaworski, later the Watergate special prosecutor, the list read more like the sponsors of the United Way than a plan that appeared likely to end up dumping the Mississippi River on the expiring plains. As an accident of geography made the rescue of West Texas so difficult and expensive, however, an accident of migration made passage of the referendum at least as difficult. In California, the conservative and reactionary factions of the state's electorate are concentrated mainly in the sprawl south of Los Angeles, in San Diego, and in the hard-bitten little cities of the San Joaquin Valley. Every one of those places is a desert or semi-desert, haunted by extinction, and every one of them saw the state water project as salvation. An unknown number of people whose antipathy to government runs to things such as fluoridated water and Social Security voted enthusiastically for the most expensive public works project in California's history. In Texas, the ultra-conservative faction of the electorate tends to be spread more around the state. If it has a center, it is probably Houston, which stood to gain virtually nothing from the Texas water plan. The mayor of Houston, in fact, was conspicuously absent among those big city mayors who had enlisted as members of the Committee of 500. Dallas, another conservative bastion, was to get water, but felt no sense of desperate need. Aside from that, Texas's population as a whole is skewed to the east, where the main problems with water tend to come in the form of thunderstorms, hurricanes, and floods. In California, two-thirds of the population resides in the drought-ridden south. The opponents of Amendment 2 were strange bedfellows, says Ronnie Duggar. You had the Sierra Club voting with the little old ladies in tennis shoes. When the final count was in, the Texas Water Plan had lost by 6,600 votes. About a year before the referendum on Amendment 2 was held, Congressman George Mahone, the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, had asked Jim Casey over for a chat between fellow West Texans. Mahone came from Lubbock and was old enough to remember it as a one-horse town. He had a fear that things could return to that, Casey remembers. It haunted him. As Casey expected, the conversation immediately came around to the Texas water plan. He asked me what my gut reaction was, Casey remembers. Did I think it would fly? I told him, I hate to tell you this frankly, but my gut reaction is that it's crazy. I'll never forget the look on his face. It was like I was a doctor telling him his daughter was going to die. Casey's pessimism notwithstanding, Mahone was adamant about studying the plan. He even had an amendment ready for the appropriations bill, giving the Bureau whatever money it needed to perform a feasibility report. I told him that a feasibility report on a plan this big was going to consume a hell of a lot of man-hours and money. But I told him if he insisted, we'd do it, because this plan made more sense to me than some of the other cockamamie ideas that were floating around. If it turned out to be infeasible, then we'd all get better ready to kiss irrigation on the high plains goodbye. The figures Casey's staff began toting up over the next 3 years were appalling. Routing the aqueduct across wet Louisiana and southeastern Texas would be a costly nightmare, even if the Bureau didn't have to pay for bodyguards to protect its construction crews. The Louisiana legislature told us to go ahead and study it because the numbers would kill us anyway, Casey remembers. But if we'd actually gone ahead and tried to build the thing, God knows what might have happened. I felt like taking out a new life insurance policy before going into the bayous down there. The aqueduct would have to go underneath four major rivers by siphon. 142 minor streams would be siphoned under it. But what encumbered the Mississippi diversion most of all was its gluttonous appetite for energy. Carry two buckets of water up the Washington Monument, take the elevator back down, and do it five more times. That was the lift we had to overcome to West Texas. We were talking billions of buckets. We were talking trillions of buckets, says Casey. There was not nearly enough surplus power in Texas, so the project would have to build its own generating plants. The Bureau decided to go the nuclear route, on the widely held belief that nuclear electricity would soon be dirt cheap. We took the most pie-eyed projections we could find from the Atomic Energy Commission. We figured the plants would cost $250 million apiece. The plan required about 12 of them, 12 nuclear plants of 1 million kilowatts each. You couldn't build one nuclear plant in 1985 for the price we thought we were going to pay for 12 in 1971. Notwithstanding power price estimates that were beyond the realm of fantasy, the Texas Water Plan, which in the Bureau's version was somewhat larger than Texas's own, would consume $325 million worth of power every year in 1971 dollars. The West Texas farmers would end up with a water bill of $330 an acre foot, all because of the relentless upslope of the plains. The most they could possibly pay, the Bureau decided, was $125, and that was hocus-pocus, says Casey. Taxpayers, therefore, would subsidize the rest. The benefit-cost ratio ultimately worked out to 0.27 to 1. For every dollar invested, there would be 27 cents worth of economic return. The disparity between primary benefits and costs is so great that there is no reasonable prospect that any plan for transporting Mississippi River water to West Texas or eastern Mexico would become favorable, the Bureau's report read. And it continued, it is unlikely that the project described could be completed in time to prevent virtual cessation of groundwater irrigation on the Texas High Plains and large-scale reduction of such irrigation in eastern New Mexico. If there was any justification for it at all, it was that the project could contribute significantly to population dispersion in the 21st century if this becomes a national objective. In the Ogallala region, the Bureau's conclusions were met initially with discouragement, but not despair. Everyone knew that the Bureau and the Corps had built projects which made a little better sense. They were merely smaller. The real issue, as far as Texas and Kansas and Oklahoma and Colorado and New Mexico were concerned, was that one couldn't simply abandon millions of acres of farmland to the desert from which it had so recently been saved. One couldn't let another Dust Bowl occur. The economics might look bad now, but who knew how they would look in 30 years? By the turn of the century, according to projections, there would be 10 billion people, maybe more, on the planet. Who would feed them? Who still had land? The Russians did, but they couldn't feed themselves. Neither could Europe. Asia was thick with humanity. In Java, people would kill for enough land to raise a couple of cows. Australia was not only a desert, but unlike the American West, a desert without rivers. Could anyone imagine Africa feeding the world? Canada was too cold to grow much of anything besides wheat and cattle. The only place left was South America. But when you chop down rainforests and try to grow crops, the soil turned to laterite, hard as stone. On the high plains, you still have 5 or 10 feet of loamy topsoil. You had 1% of the farmers on 6% of the nation's agricultural land growing 15% of the wheat, corn, cotton, and grain sorghum. You had American technology, American know-how. You had the most productive region of the nation that was the food larder of the world. You had cities of 100,000, 200,000 people which depended utterly on irrigation farming and oil and gas. Could the nation just abandon them to fate, like the Leadvilles and Silver Cities and Bodies of 100 years ago? From the look of things, it would. After the Bureau's report was released, one heard little about the Texas Water Plan for a number of years. In 1976 and again in 1981, Texans rejected water bonds that appeared likely to set the plan in motion. Arkansas and Louisiana began to talk of their water as if it were their daughter's chastity. The farmers, meanwhile, were still in business. By the late 1970s, however, the Ogallala had dropped several more feet while energy prices had gone up sevenfold in a decade. The first farmers began going bankrupt, in Texas and Colorado and Kansas and New Mexico. Tens of thousands of acres began reverting to dry land. The press, tantalized by the prospect of an imminent catastrophe, finally took some interest. Newspaper and magazine stories appeared by the dozen. The result of all this was a predictable welter of federal studies, the most important of which was the 1982 Six-State High Plains Ogallala Area Study, coordinated by the Economic Development Administration of the Department of Commerce. The study, as expected, predicted calamity, but decided it would not arrive as soon as most people thought. By the year 2020, which was as far ahead as it looked, Texas's share of the Ogallala would be down to 87.2 million acre-feet from 283.7 million in 1977. New Mexico's would be all but used up. Colorado and Kansas would be somewhat better off. Irrigation in those states would increase over the near term, then begin to decline early in the 21st century. The real reckoning would come after 2020. Nebraska, however, would still overlie 1.9 billion acre-feet by then and would be irrigating 11.5 million acres, far more than any state in the nation. Irrigation farming would simply move northward, leaving Lubbock, Clovis, and Lyman behind. In Texas, according to the report, oil and gas production would be down to 7% of its 1977 level, a double blow that could make the fate of cities such as Buffalo appear benign. The economy of the Southern Plains would be a three-legged stool with two legs gone, unless some miraculous rise in agricultural prices, or some new source of cheap energy, or some revolution in DNA plant genetics came along, permitting corn to get by on 14 inches of rain. The region would be, to use Jim Casey's phrase, an Appalachia without trees. The only commodities in abundance would be sun and wind. Is it possible that the 1982 report's conclusions are overly optimistic? It's possible, says Herbert Grubb, the planning director of the Texas Water Development Board. When I saw the rate of increase they used for energy costs, I thought it was much too low. In the late 70s, I'd been hearing estimates of oil costing as much as $295 a barrel by the end of the century. It turns out now that they were pretty much on target, at least so far. A lot of us didn't expect an oil glut to materialize in the early 1980s, but no one can say how long it will last. If in 10 years we get another series of price jolts like we did in the 70s, I don't see how the irrigators can keep pumping. From a national perspective, forgetting about the farmer's plight, whether irrigation on the southern plains ends in 30 years or in 7 or even in 50 years does not matter. The fact is, it will mostly end. The more important issue, from that same perspective, is what will happen then, not just to the farmers and the cost of food and the balance of payments deficits, but to the land. When thousands of farmers on millions of irrigated acres can no longer afford to pump vanishing water, the dilemma they face will be universal. How to survive on a finite amount of acreage that has suddenly become one-fifth to one-eighth as productive as it was. The answer is foreordained. They cannot. Many of them, therefore, will sell out to more stubborn neighbors and head for the cities for work or relief. Those who remain on enough acreage to offer them a glimmer of hope will ponder their brief list of choices. They can try to raise dryland cotton or wheat or some desert crop, jojoba or guayuli, perhaps, or they can try to revert their plowed fields to short grass prairie and raise cattle. Raising cattle, perhaps even buffalo, which outperform cattle in arid country, might seem the thing to do. However, it is hard to see how it will happen without billions of dollars' worth of federal support. To convert from, say, wheat to grassland, a farmer first needs to plant some fast-growing annuals, such as rye, to develop a litter cover for the soil and build up its organic content. It will cost him perhaps $15 an acre and require a year. Then he has to seed gamma grass. This costs him even more and takes another year. Finally, if the grass manages to take hold, a lot of it won't, he can begin grazing a few cattle and reseeding those areas that fail to propagate. If he owns 1,000 acres, he will probably have spent $30,000 to $50,000, valued circa 1984. It has taken him 3 years, and he hasn't earned a dime. He still has his living expenses to cover, and unless he is a well-established farmer, a small mountain of unpaid debts. Once his grass is growing, he may still have to wait years for his cattle to mature. After 7 years or so, he will finally begin to earn some income. But by then he will have fallen into a bottomless hole. Farmers may therefore resist the temptation to raise cattle and do the economically sensible thing, raise a dry land crop. As Paul Sears wrote in Deserts on the March, so long as there remains the most remote possibility that the drier grasslands, whose sod has been destroyed by the plow, can be made to yield crops under cultivation, we may count upon human stubbornness to return again and again to the attack. And in that effort lurks the likelihood of a recurrence of the catastrophe that inspired Sears' book, The Dust Bowl. When a $1 million home perched on a 50-degree slope above Malibu is clobbered by a mudslide after 3 weeks of rain, as thousands of houses throughout California were during the El Niño winters of 1982 and 1983, their owners tend to think of themselves as the victims of a natural disaster. The Dust Bowl of the 1930s is commonly regarded as such a natural disaster because 7 dry years in a row were accompanied by fierce winds which scoured up the topmost layer of Oklahoma and blew it as far as Norway. The climate of the plains has remained relatively unchanged for hundreds of years, however, and there is no convincing evidence that such a disaster ever occurred before white men plowed up the sod and brought in cattle, or much worse, sheep to graze it down. Even after 7 years of drought, the Dust Bowl would probably not have occurred had not man created the conditions for it. By 1932, in Texas alone, 70 million acres of land that had once been covered with a blanket of grass were growing mesquite and thorny weeds, which are poor at holding soil in place. The weeds had no business there. They were native to the ultramontane basins several hundred miles west. As Paul Sears wrote, weeds, like wild-eyed anarchists, are the symptoms, not the real cause, of a disturbed order. When the Russian thistle swept down across the western ranges, the general opinion was that it was a devouring plague, crowding in and consuming the native plants. It was no such thing. The native vegetation had already been destroyed by the plow and thronging herds, the ground was vacated, and the thistles took it over. The Dust Bowl occurred after a profitable wheat market had coincided for years with, by plains standards, a spell of abundant moisture. Prices were high enough to inspire greed. The farmers began plowing up everything in sight. Millions of acres of fragile, highly erodible land, from New Mexico all the way up to the Dakotas, had their sod pierced and replaced by wheat. The farmers actually began going bust before the drought even began. A glutted market, international competition, high tariffs, and the impoverished condition of post-war Europe conspired to do them in. The Dust Bowl was the coup de grace. The second Dust Bowl is apt to result from hardship rather than 1920-style prosperity, though the pattern of land abuse will be pretty much the same. As the Ogallala Aquifer steadily runs out, and the surviving farmers watch their debts mount and their living standards decline, they will be forced by financial need to acquire and dry farm as much new land as they can, unless they can still afford to pump irrigation water on an emergency basis during droughts. If there is any water left to pump under their land, they will no longer be guaranteed a respectable harvest every year. Because of the high profits of irrigation, the plains farmers took a lot of marginal farmland out of production over the past few decades. They could afford to. Now it is likely to be returned to the plow. In the East, marginal land usually means rocks or swamps or steep hillsides. On the rockless, swampless tabletop plains, it usually means fine sand. Most of western Nebraska is sand, so is a lot of eastern New Mexico and west Texas. In western Kiowa County, Colorado, 150,000 acres of sandy Class 6 land, Class 1 is the best, are already in production, losing 20 tons of topsoil or more a year. There is also a lot of marginal land in production in the Portales region of eastern New Mexico. The winds blow hardest on the southern plains in late winter and early spring. Days of 60-mile-per-hour gusts ripping across empty space, powered by convoluted airflows battling one another. On February 23, 1977, some of those winds blew into Portales country and began raising dust. A dust storm works on the principle of an avalanche. Wind scours up some loose soil and forms a dense, stinging cloud of fine particles, which scours up more loose soil and more until a horizon is filled by an advancing wave several thousand feet high, churning and swirling millions of tons of suspended matter. When these storms were first sighted in the 1930s, farmers ran inside their houses fearing torrential rain. When they went back outside, their homes had lost their paint and their chickens were featherless. The Portales storm, which lasted only about a day and a half, removed 40 tons of topsoil per acre from parts of Roosevelt and Kiowa counties, as much topsoil loss as rainfall causes in a year in the most erosion-prone parts of the East, and about 3 centuries' worth of topsoil formation on the arid plains. Early in 1984, the same thing happened in parts of West Texas, south of Lubbock. One reason the storms did not grow out of control was that a lot of the surrounding irrigated land was being prepared for planting and was wet. Wayne Wyatt, the manager of the Texas High Plains Underground Water Conservation District in Lubbock, a man now presiding over the most desperate water conservation effort in the United States, does not believe irrigation will end on the southern plains in a spectacular cloud of dust. In the 30s, says Wyatt, most of the farmers were still plowing with mules. They had power to dig down about 4 or 5 inches. Now they have 100-horsepower tractors, which can easily bring up soil from 2 feet. It's either wet or it's clayey enough to hold against the wind. The only way I can see another dust bowl is if we have a real long drought. If it goes on for years in a row, and the farmers can't even manage one crop in between, and if it affects this whole country and not just a piece of it, then maybe it could happen again. But this region has never known a drought like that. Even during the big one, there were a couple of years when you could raise a dry land crop. I asked Wyatt how far back climatic records go on the southern plains. They go back to about the 1880s, was his response. Wyatt, a courtly ex-farmer, I beat my brains out trying to make a go of it, who speaks in an almost opaque drawl, is rather optimistic about the future of the plains. Half of the land around Lubbock is still dry farmed. Farmers have been getting crops for 40-50 years. Their costs are that much lower that they can make a profit, somehow. And I'm not sure the aquifer is going to run out so fast. Conservation is a religion around here now. We have farmers who've cut their water use in half. Anyone who doesn't conserve tends to lose his friends fast. We've begun experimenting with capillary water, the water that the soil draws up from the aquifer and that saturates the layer above it. You can't pump it, but by injecting compressed air into the soil there, you squeeze it out like a sponge and it drains into the aquifer. Our economist thinks capillary water could be available for $25 to $50 an acre foot. The farmers can lease air compressors from the oil industry as their reserves give out. Then you still have to pump the water up, but with enough conservation, I think they can afford it. Capillary water could prolong the life of the Ogallala by another 20 to 40 years. This, then, is the plains region today, a place that is reverting slowly and steadily into an amphitheater of natural forces toying with its inhabitants' fate. Besides the constant threat of drought and wind, there are half a dozen other swords suspended over their heads. They are as vulnerable to nuclear power plant fiascos in Washington State as they are to the debt crisis in Latin America. A couple of percentage point increases in interest rates, coupled with a collapse of the nuclear industry, which would put a premium on oil and gas, all of it occurring when rainfall drops from 18 inches to 12, could send them into a death spiral of debt, cost, and dust that might seal their fate. Meanwhile, The promise of water arriving from somewhere else when the aquifer begins running out is slipping almost out of view. Touring the region and speaking with farmers and politicians and bankers, one doesn't hear much of rescue anymore, though the subject is on everyone's mind. According to Steve Reynolds, the former state engineer of New Mexico, the odds against a rescue project being built have gone from maybe 50-50 20 years ago to 80-20 again today. Reynolds said he frankly doesn't see how society will make this kind of investment in our behalf. This, despite his region's tremendously important contribution to America's agricultural export production, the only thing that lets us pay for all we import. But then he spread his lanky frame out in his chair, scratched a plaster of mud off his boot. One of Steve Reynolds' leisure activities was walking along his state's meager rivers and pulling phreatophytes out by their roots, and began to veer toward one of his favorite subjects, microwave energy stations in space. One of those microwave satellites could produce 10,000 megawatts of power. That's enough to power the whole project. I've never felt that we should give up on space. It's our last frontier, and we need one. One of those microwave satellites would be a way to make space exploration economically useful. Even the economists who have looked into a water importation project for the plains and pronounced it absurd seem unable to give up on the idea. Such is our reluctance to let nature regain control, to suffer the fate of nearly all the irrigated civilizations of antiquity. In 1982, the High Plains Ogallala Aquifer Region study projected an impossible cost of $300 to $800 per acre foot for water imported into the region. But then it added, "The only long-term solution to declining groundwater supplies and maintaining a permanent irrigated agricultural economy in most of the High Plains region is the development of alternate water supplies. Although emerging technologies for local water supply augmentation offer some potential for alleviating the overdraft of the aquifer, none could provide sustained and replenishable supplies to meet the region's needs. Therefore, regional water transfer potentials should be continued and expanded to feasibility and planning levels." Such investigations, the authors added in a cryptic sentence whose meaning will become clear later on, should be international as well as national in scope. The overdraft of groundwater on the High Plains is the greatest in the nation, in the world, in all of human history, but it is merely an enormous manifestation of a common phenomenon throughout the West. On the east side of the San Joaquin Valley in California, enough groundwater disappears every year to supply Illinois. The overdraft is projected nearly to double in 18 years. Tucson and El Paso have fewer than 80 years of water left even after raiding neighboring basins. They will have to get more from somewhere else. The overdraft in Arizona is rapidly forcing the state into an urban economy. There is a serious overdraft in parts of central and eastern Oregon, which pales so much beside the Ogallala, Arizona, and California overdrafts one hardly hears it mentioned outside the state. Groundwater overdraft is, moreover, a phenomenon not limited to the West. Long Island, sitting atop a closed basin aquifer, is both depleting it and poisoning it with chemical wastes. Where it could go for more water is an interesting question, since there isn't any available within 400 or 500 miles that anyone seems willing to give up. Of all these places, the only one that now appears likely to bring its use of water in balance with its supply is Arizona, mainly because it has little choice. The probable result, of course, is that irrigation farming will largely disappear unless Colorado River water, brought in through the Central Arizona Project, is sold to the farmers at incredibly subsidized rates. It was in Arizona, by ironic coincidence, that the only great desert civilization ever established in North America in earlier times disappeared, either for want of water, or perhaps more likely, because of a surfeit of salt. A few hundred million years ago, the waters of the oceans were still fresh enough to drink. It is the earth that contains the mineral salts one tastes in seawater. The salts are in all runoff leached out of rock and soil. The runoff concentrates in rivers which end up in the oceans, or, as in the case of Mono Lake and Great Salt Lake, in closed basin sumps up to 7 times saltier than the sea. Once in the ocean, The salts have no place to go. The seas are stuck with them. When the water is evaporated, the salts remain behind. When the water falls as rain and becomes runoff again, a fresh batch of salts washes in. Like DDT and pelican eggshells, the salts in the ocean are testimony to the effects of concentration. As the evaporative cycle is repeated, day after day, year after year, millennium after millennium, eon after eon, the oceans grow saltier all the time. On March 24, 1992, the dissolved salt content in ocean water off San Francisco was about 35,000 parts per million, perhaps a fraction of a ppm higher than it was 10,000 years ago. The process is so incredibly slow and immense that, for once, no act of man seems capable of affecting it by the tiniest measurable iota. What is changing, what has changed drastically in the very recent past, is the concentration of salts in some of the world's river and in some of its preeminent agricultural land. Explaining the collapse of ancient civilizations is a cottage industry within the anthropological and archaeological professions, like the riddle of the dinosaurs. The explanations vary considerably. Some blame their demise on chronic human failings, degeneracy, conflict, war. The decline of Rome, according to some, was the result of the Romans' use of lead in their eating and drinking utensils, since lead causes irreversible brain damage if eaten or ingested in fairly small amounts. The theory offers a tempting explanation for the obviously demented behavior of certain Roman leaders. It does not, however, explain why most Romans were demonstrably sane or why there was so much genius about. Because most of the great civilizations rose in deserts or semi-deserts, a popular explanation has always been drought. A drought beyond any that modern mankind has known, perhaps caused by aberrant sunspot cycles or some huge volcanic eruptions that changed the climate. The most fruitful of the ancient cultures grew up at the southeastern end of the Fertile Crescent, the broad valley formed by the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in what is now Iraq. From there, civilization appears to have spread eastward into Persia and on to Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and China. Later, it spread to the west. Most of the Romans' fabled feats of hydrologic engineering were borrowed from the Assyrians, who borrowed them from their predecessors, the Sumerians. In the 7th century BC, the Assyrians, under Sennacherib, built an inverted siphon into the Nineveh aqueduct, a feat of hydrologic engineering which was not really improved upon until New York City built a pressurized siphon into its second Croton aqueduct in the 1860s. For all its precocious brilliance and innovation, however, the southern part of the Fertile Crescent went into eclipse around the year 2000 BC. When Babylon rose in the 18th century BC, many impressive Sumerian cities lay in ruins around it, as Babylon itself would lie desolated centuries later. The story was repeated nearly everywhere, even in the New World, where a number of remarkable civilizations arose and prospered independently. One of the most impressive was the Hohokam civilization in central Arizona, which left as its legacy some 700 miles of irrigation canals. Sometime around the 14th century, however, the Hohokam vanished, reason unknown. The Inca, Aztec, and Maya used irrigation too, though they didn't rely on it as absolutely as the Hohokam. Their fate was sealed by European invaders, so it is perhaps idle speculation whether they would ultimately have gone the route of their predecessors in Mesopotamia and elsewhere. Whatever the answer, it appears that only one civilization completely dependent on irrigation managed to survive uninterruptedly for thousands of years. That civilization was Egypt, but Egypt was fundamentally different from the others in one way. The survival of a civilization depends mainly on sufficient food. But what makes a civilization great? Traveling across the United States, Lewis and Clark saw few fat Indians until they had arrived at the mouth of the Columbia River, where the Chinook were gorging themselves on salmon, oysters, and clams. With plenty of time for leisure, the Northwest Indians were making exquisite crafts and living in impressive lodges. Farther north, the Haida, similarly well-fed, had ample time and energy to commit cruel depredations on fellow tribes in magnificent war canoes carved from whole trees. When we think of a great civilization, however, we think of great cities, of sublime architecture and monuments, of intricate governmental and social structures, of engineering ability which startles even the jaded modern observer. By that standard, neither the Chinook nor any of the other cultures in North America, except the Hohokam, was great. Individually, the Indians could be incredibly skillful as horsemen, warriors, hunters, artisans, but their high achievement was just that, individual. Even where Indians shared a common language, they broke up into small, separate tribes that, for the most part, went their own way. In contrast to the collectivism of the great Mediterranean, Indus Valley, or Mayan city-states, North American Indian culture was fragmented, atomized, ephemeral. Most of the great Mediterranean civilizations arose in a region notable for its benign weather. But the climate in California is very similar to that of southern Italy and Greece, and California was a gastronomical paradise on earth, with salmon in the rivers, acorns for the taking, whales grounding themselves on beaches, and enormous herds and flocks of game. But the Huroc and Miwok and Paiute tribes were living in caves and under trees when the Greeks and Romans were building aqueducts and the Parthenon. An answer to this riddle begins to emerge when one considers that nearly all the great early civilizations were irrigated ones. That single act, irrigation, seems inextricably linked to their ascendance, as well as to their demise. Any people who for the first time managed to divert a river and seduce a crop out of the wasted land had tweaked the majestic indifference of the universe. To bring off the feat demanded tremendous collective will, discipline, planning, a sense of shared goals. To sustain it required order, which led to the creation of powerful priesthoods, of bureaucracies. Irrigation invited large concentrations of people because of all the food. It probably demanded such concentrations because of all the work. Out of this, cities grew. Work became specialized. There had to be engineers, builders, architects, farmers, probably even lawyers, for the disputes over water rights among upstream and downstream irrigators could not have been much different from today's. The ample supply of food may have helped in the keeping of slaves. In California, during the mission days, some of the Indians signed themselves into absolute servitude with the padres in exchange for the certitude of being fed. Once established, irrigated civilizations in the desert were incredibly well off. Before modern weapons, sheer numbers meant power, so they were formidable in war. Oases in hostile deserts, they would have been difficult to approach and attack. The desert was also a healthy place to live. There was no tsetse fly, no malarial swamp, no raging cold and chilling wind. Because everyone was out of doors much of the time, the spread of disease was much less of a risk than in colder climates. Famine was an almost forgotten nemesis. Food was also a wonderful commodity for trade. Mesopotamia had virtually no metals, but it produced enough food to trade not only for iron and bronze, but for a phenomenal wealth of gold. Trade was also a way of exchanging ideas. It was through contact with the Assyrians and Greeks that the Romans learned to build aqueducts. There were, of course, problems. Canals could silt up or wash out in floods. A rigid bureaucratic order could spawn revolution. Any disruption of the water supply, by an earthquake, a drought, would be catastrophic. But those were not the kinds of problems likely to crush civilizations as ingenious as these. They might take their toll, along with wars and plagues, but it seems unlikely they would have sent them into permanent eclipse, or, as in the case of the Hohokam, cause a whole civilization simply to vanish off the face of the earth. There had to be another enemy, something subtle, unseen, subversive. It was likely to be something they could do little or nothing about, something which they may not even have understood, and thus might have been inclined to ascribe to vengeance from gods. Contemplating the list of enemies, natural and man-made, that might fit such a description, more and more anthropologists and archaeologists are concluding that the one that fits it best is salt. Irrigation is a profoundly unnatural act. It hardly occurs in nature, and that which does occur is mostly along the rare desert rivers like the Nile, that produce a reliable seasonal flood. In Africa and a few other places, there are natural depressions where runoff collects during rainy seasons, greening the land when it recedes. For every one of those, however, there are dozens of dead saline lakes or lake beds where the same thing used to happen and where today nothing can grow. They are common in Nevada, Groom Lake, Newark Lake, Goshute Lake, Winnemucca Lake, China Lake, Searles Lake, Cuddleback Lake, big saucers of salt left over from shallow Pleistocene seas, when the climate of Nevada was more like Sichuan. The waters that filled those lakes came down from ranges a short distance away, but in that brief intimacy with soil and rock had already accumulated enough salts to spell death for the basin below. Man-made irrigation faces the same problem. In the West, many soils are classified as saline or alkaline. Irrigation water percolates through them, then returns to the river. It is diverted downstream, used again, and returned to the river. On rivers like the Colorado and the Platte, the same water may be used 18 times over. It also spends a good deal of its time in the reservoirs, which in desert country may lose 8 to 12 feet off their surface to the sun every year. The process continues. Salts are picked up, fresh water evaporates, more salts are picked up, more fresh water evaporates. The hydrologist Arthur Pillsbury, writing in Scientific American in July of 1981, estimated that of the 120 million acre-feet of water applied to irrigated American crops the previous year, 90 million acre-feet were lost to evaporation and transpiration by plants. The remaining 30 million acre-feet contained virtually all of the salts. Above a heavily irrigated strip of land along the Pecos River in New Mexico, water taken from the river has a measured salinity level of about 720 parts per million. 30 miles beyond, salinity levels have shot up to 2,020 parts per million, almost entirely because of irrigation. 2,020 parts per million spells death for many crops. Near its headwaters in the Colorado Rockies, the Arkansas River shows only a trace of salts. 120 miles downriver, it contains 2,200 parts per million. The Colorado, a river whose importance is absurdly disproportionate to its size, has the worst problem with salt of any American river. There are small tributaries flowing out of the salt-ridden Piceance Basin with measured concentrations of as much as 90,000 parts per million, 3 tablespoons in a cup, so it is plagued by natural resources to begin with. In the Grand Valley of Colorado, irrigation water runs through sedimentary salt formations on its subterranean return to the river, reaching saline levels 30 times higher than at the diversion point. Below, there are 2 huge reservoirs, Powell and Meade, evaporating 1.5 million acre-feet of pure water each year, at least a tenth of the river's flow. It should come as no surprise, then, that by the time the Colorado River has entered Mexico, its waters are almost illegal. Behind Jan van Skilfgaarde's desk in his office at the Department of Agriculture's Salinity Control Laboratory in 1982 is a plaque proclaiming him a member of the Drainage Hall of Fame. Drainage seems like a pedestrian business, and van Skilfgaarde is an uncommonly sophisticated and witty man, so one wonders what odd fortune married him to this issue. As he explains it, however, drainage becomes the most difficult aspect of irrigation, rather like fine-tuning a racing car. In fact, on the face of things, drainage would appear a more challenging problem than building dams. On the Columbia River, Grand Coulee Dam is in place, impassive and content. Next door, in the Columbia Basin Project, the battle against poor drainage and salts is still going on. When you apply irrigation water, says van Skilfgaarde, it has to go somewhere. If it drains back off into the river quickly, then that's fine. If it drains down to an underlying aquifer, fine, at least for a while. If it doesn't drain, or drains too slowly, then you have problems. Salts build up in the root zones, the soil becomes waterlogged. Ultimately, you can damage the structure of the soil, ruining it forever. So you have to get rid of it. How? Where? These are tremendous problems in places with lots of poorly drained land that apply tens of millions of acre-feet of water per year, like the American West. Basically, You can take the macro or the micro approach. You can build big drain systems, desalination plants, and so on, but you are still left with saline wastewater or pure salt to dispose of. Or you can tune your crop mix and your irrigation system to the reality of poor drainage and saline water and keep the problem at bay. That is what we have been doing here with considerable success. I keep telling people this, but they don't want to listen to me. Here is the Department of Agriculture's Salinity Control Laboratory, of which von Skilfgaarde was then director. It sits in the shadow of a hulking butte near the city of Riverside, California, surrounded by the very last agricultural land in the Los Angeles basin. 60 years ago, this was acre for acre the richest farming region in the world. Los Angeles County led the nation in farm income. Today, the main crop in the basin is tract housing. Displaced by 12 million people, agriculture moved eastward and northward into the San Joaquin Valley, which has one of the worst drainage problems in the world. Salinity is the monkey on irrigation's back, says von Skilfgaarde. The good water goes up in the sky and the junk water goes down, so the problem gets worse and worse. Viktor Kovda of the University of Moscow says the amount of land going out of production due to salinity now surpasses the amount being brought into production through new irrigation. In this country, we have lost a few tens of thousands of acres, actually a few hundreds of thousands if you include the Welton Mohawk project in Arizona, on which we later spent a fortune in order to bring salted-out land back into production. But that figure is projected to increase drastically in the decades ahead. The problem is an abstraction to most people, like projections of declining oil reserves were back in the 1960s. If you want to see how bad it can get, go to Iraq. Thousands of years before the birth of Christ, the Sumerians in the Fertile Crescent were already getting some experience with salinity firsthand. Counts of grain impressions in excavated pottery from sites in what is now southern Iraq, pottery that has been carbon dated back to 3500 BC, suggest that at the time, the amount of wheat grown was roughly equal to the amount of barley. 1,000 years later, wheat production had dropped by 83%. It wasn't that the Sumerians suddenly developed an insatiable craving for barley. They were forced to switch because wheat is one of the least salt-tolerant crops. Between 2400 BC and 1700 BC, barley yields in Sumeria declined from 2500 per hectare, a highly respectable yield even today, to 900 liters per hectare. Not long afterward, massive crop failures began. Sodium ions tend to be absorbed by colloidal clay particles, deflocculating them, reads an article in Science magazine from 1958. The first authoritative report linking the demise of Sumeria to salt. This leaves the resultant structureless soil almost impermeable to water. In general, high salt concentrations obstruct germination and impede the absorption of water and nutrients by plants. Salts accumulate steadily in the water table, which has only very limited lateral movement to carry them away. Hence, the groundwater everywhere in southern Iraq has become extremely saline. New waters added as excessive irrigation, rains, or floods can raise the level of the water table very considerably under the prevailing conditions of inadequate drainage. With a further capillary rise when the soil is wet, the dissolved salts and exchangeable sodium are brought into the root zone or even to the surface, killing the crops. As the authors, Torkil Jacobson and Robert Adams, suggested, Iraq is still struggling with its most ancient nemesis. It can feed itself mainly because it exports oil. At least 20% of its arable land, which doesn't amount to much, is permanently destroyed and can never be returned to cultivation. Probably there is no single explanation, the authors wrote, but that growing soil salinity played an important part in the breakup of Sumerian civilization seems beyond question. Von Skilfgaarde's approach to the salinity problem is not the one favored by the farmers, the Bureau of Reclamation, and members of Congress in whose districts the problem lies. The Bureau says we've analyzed the solutions I am talking about and they've been discredited, which is utter nonsense. Nobody has had the guts to implement them. I'm an outcast at every meeting I go to. The solutions favored by von Skilfgaarder belong to a kind of jujitsu style. The prevailing wisdom is to attack the problem with tanks and planes. I've been saying for years that the solution to this problem is better management, very careful management, he says, his urbane Dutch manner giving way to rising exasperation. Certain crops can take high salinity levels. At our experimental plots in the San Joaquin Valley, we have been growing cotton for 6 years with 5,900 parts per million water and getting 50% higher yields. The salt stress seems to stunt the plants, but doesn't affect their production of cotton flowers. The water also has boron in it. An average irrigator wouldn't touch it. This shows that you can use water on one crop, then on one that tolerates salt better, then bring it back and use it again on a still more salt-tolerant crop before letting it go. You use a lot less, which means that you have less to get rid of in poorly drained areas such as the San Joaquin Valley. The cost is low, about $10 an acre. The cost of the Yuma desalination plant is officially up to $300 million. The Yuma desalination plant, its operation chronically delayed, is an example of a tanks and guns approach. In the 1940s, with the Central Arizona Project deadlocked in Congress, the Bureau of Reclamation was anxious to build something in that state, not only to mollify its citizenry and the increasingly powerful Carl Hayden, but also give its regional office, suffering existential malaise after the completion of Hoover Dam, something new to do. Along the lower Gila River were several tons of thousands of prime irrigable acres which had been irrigated off and on by Spanish, Indians, and Americans for the past 300 years. Unfortunately, the region, named Welton Mohawk after two desert hamlets located there, is plagued by poor drainage. The Bureau revived the region by installing, at considerable expense, an elaborate drainage system to carry the wastewater away. Perforated tiles were laid several feet beneath the land, which led into a master drain that emptied into the Colorado River above the Mexican border. The project was completed in the early 1960s, just as the Bureau was closing the gates of Glen Canyon Dam. The effect of those two actions, a sudden surge of water containing 6,300 parts per million of salts, accompanied by a drastic reduction of fresh surplus flows from above, gave the Mexicans fits. Below the border, the salinity of the Colorado River shot up from around 800 to more than 1,500 parts per million. The Mexicali region is the most productive in the entire country, which suffers not only from frightening population growth, but from a woefully archaic, unbalanced, and inefficient agricultural sector. All the irrigation around Mexicali is utterly dependent on the river. Only a well-managed irrigation system, which the Mexicans did not have, could tolerate such levels of salt, and even then, under some duress. Predictably, crop yields went into abject decline. The Mexicans were all the more incensed because the United States seemed so unconcerned about their plight. We had promised them 1.5 million acre-feet of water a year, which they were still getting. The compact, U.S. officials pointed out, contained no guarantees about water quality as long as there was enough. President Luis Echeverria campaigned heavily on the issue, and after winning the election, threatened to keep his promise to haul the United States before the World Court at The Hague. In 1973, for reasons which are still obscure, but which might conceivably have had something to do with the fact that Mexico showed some promise of owning a great deal of oil, President Richard Nixon appointed a former U.S. Attorney General, Herbert Brownell, to work out a hasty solution. Signed 6 months later, in August of 1974, the agreement, known as Minute 242, calls for the United States to deliver Mexico water whose salt content is not more than 115 parts per million, plus or minus 30 parts per million, higher than measured levels at Imperial Dam in 1976, a level that turned out to be 879 parts per million. As a result, salinity levels at the border of 1,000 parts per million or above, and they have almost reached such levels, are a violation of international law. The simplest and cheapest way to solve Mexico's salinity crisis would have been for the U.S. government to buy out the Welton Mohawk farmers and retire their lands. Even today, a generous settlement probably would not cost more than a couple of $100 million, and a tremendous source of salts would be removed. Retiring some additional irrigated lands in the Grand Valley of Colorado, another prodigious source of salts, would be further insurance against the problem getting out of hand. None of this has, of course, happened. The solution of choice at Welton Mohawk has been the construction of a reverse osmosis desalination plant, 10 times larger than any in the world, which, while consuming enough electricity to satisfy a city of 40,000 people, will treat the wastewater running out the drain canal. The solution of choice in the Grand Valley is at least as expensive but more prosaic. Lining irrigation canals to prevent seepage through subsurface salt zones is the main one. The legislation authorizing all of these works belongs in a class of congressional sacred cows. Whatever it costs to keep salinity levels down without retiring an acre of salt-ridden land is what Congress is willing to spend. The Yuma plant is now supposed to cost $293 million, a figure hardly anyone outside the Bureau believes, and the Upper Basin Works could cost another $600 million, perhaps much more. Energy costs could easily push the Yuma plant's cost to $1 billion or more over 50 years. What Congress has chosen to do, in effect, is purify water at a cost exceeding $300 an acre-foot so that upriver irrigators can continue to grow surplus crops with federally subsidized water that costs them $3.50 an acre-foot. If the farmers at Welton Mohawk adopted efficient irrigation methods, says Jan van Skilfgaarde, you could solve the problem without even retiring the lands. It would be quite possible to reduce their return flows from 220,000 acre-feet a year to 45,000 acre-feet. I'm not even talking about installing drip irrigation. I'm talking about laser-leveling fields and reusing water on salt-tolerant crops and not doing stupid things like irrigating at harvest time, which our neighboring farmer in the San Joaquin Valley did one year. A lot of these guys are actually absentee owners farming by telephone from their dentist's offices in Scottsdale. They hire some manager who may be competent or incompetent and they don't care. They're not in this business to farm crops or even to make a profit. They're farming the government. They're growing tax shelters. But even if you do have a highly competent farmer who wouldn't mind reducing his wastewater flows, he has no incentive to conserve. Federal water is so cheap, it might as well be free. What's the point of hiring a couple of additional irrigation managers to save free water? It's wrong to say the farmer is the culprit. He's being forced to consume water. Von Skilfgaarde's outspokenness on this subject may well have had something to do with his departure from the USDA laboratory in 1984. Meanwhile, as his salinity management approach is almost universally ignored, and the Bureau's expensive solutions receive several hundred times more money than his laboratory does, salinity levels at Imperial Dam could reach 1,150 parts per million as early as the year 2000, and keep rising even if its desalination plant operates effectively, a prospect open to considerable doubt. New projects in the Upper Basin, oil shale development, the continued leaching of saline soil, all will contribute to salinity's inexorable march. This is bad news for the Mexicans, but it is bad news for Los Angeles, too. Each additional part per million of salts in the city's Colorado River supply is estimated to cause $300,000 worth of damage basin-wide to the things the water comes in contact with, pipes, fixtures, machinery, cars. A rise in salinity levels at Imperial Dam from 900 to 1,150 parts per million, then, will cost the citizens of Southern California about $75 million a year. The Bureau's answer to all of this appears on a chart which it has available for distribution. The answer is simply described as further salinity control projects under study. Adopting these unnamed solutions, at whatever cost, is supposed to hold salinity levels at about 1,030 parts per million at Imperial Dam, still too high to meet our compact obligation to Mexico, which, since 1974, has become one of our three most important foreign suppliers of oil. The Bureau's answer to that appears on the graph as future additional measures, whatever those are. In the Colorado Basin, the effects of wastefully irrigating saline lands are not, for the most part, being felt by those doing the irrigating. thanks mainly to the taxpayers, the farmers who are contributing the lion's share of the salts to the river have had drainage facilities built which flush the problem down to someone else. In the San Joaquin Valley, it is a different story.